What makes us special? Is it that we are destined for some transcendent higher purpose? Or is that way of thinking simply delusional? On today's episode of the Live a Meaningful Story podcast, we're navigating one of the most iconic, complex pieces of science fiction. Based on Frank Herbert's 1965 novel, Dune is a stunning sci-fi epic about the power of dreams and the ways that power can be utilized for better or for worse. Even though the novel went on to inspire many other great epics such as Star Wars, its adaptations have not been well received until Denis Villeneuve's 2021 film, which was nominated for 10 Academy Awards and won 6. His film causes us to wrestle with the implications of following our dreams and how we can take control of our destiny in fulfilling those dreams. But can following our dreams lead others into a nightmare? Perhaps Dune can give us insight into how dreams both liberate and trap us into thinking that the hero's journey is all about us. Welcome to the Live a Meaningful Story podcast, where we learn how to navigate life one film at a time. We are four friends with backgrounds in storytelling, filmmaking, teaching, and narrative therapy. Join us on our quest towards telling and living our stories more meaningfully. I'm Derek Hatch.
My name is Nick Natal.
Hello, hello, everybody. I'm Joseph Wilson.
I'm Jason Lin.
All right, guys, we are doing a deep dive. We're going to jump into Dune. How's everyone doing?
Dune.
I'm doing good.
I'm doing all I try to think of something, too.
So the first couple episodes we did of this podcast was Star Wars, right? Mm-hmm. And yep. Star Wars was like childhood classic, that epic space opera fantasy fairy tale.
Yeah, this is what Zack Snyder was trying to do with Rebel Moon. This is what he was trying to do. I make a space epic.
You didn't want to hear that.
I said trying to do. It wasn't good. I agree with you. It wasn't good.
You didn't want to hear Zack Snyder.
I don't think
you
can put Zack Snyder and Denis Villeneuve
in anywhere in the same conversation.
All right.
Guys, no, Zack Snyder's been trying to make a good movie his whole career, yes.
Dang. Dang.
It's rough.
I feel like Dune is what you graduate to, right? It is the really complex adult space opera, science fiction epic that many of us, you know, the four of us at this table, you know, we didn't grow up with this. We didn't read the books. We didn't watch the 1980s David Lynch film.
Didn't know any of that.
Although I kind
of
definitely did.
You did?
When I was a child, 2 weeks ago.
See, I kind of wish I would have grown up with that. That would have been a fun childhood movie.
But I didn't know about it until like the first movie came out. And even then, I still wasn't going to see it until like Nick was like, you guys need to go see Dune.
Dune was always
that was the genesis of that.
Yeah.
Dune was always that thing I heard in the background. Like, oh yeah, that's a thing. But I never checked it out until this movie came out a few years ago. So let's go ahead and dive into it. We're going to do part one today and part two next week. And so obviously this is going to be spoilers everywhere.
Spoilers.
So if you've not read the book or if you have not seen the movie, especially part one, then please go watch that because we are going to really dissect this. And I do think that this is a story that's worth experiencing.
Please support the official release.
Yes. All right, so let's
do
the
IMAX.
Yes.
So let's do the letterboxed here, and then we'll get right into it. Beyond fear, destiny awaits. Paul Atreides, a brilliant and gifted young man born into a great destiny beyond his understanding, must travel to the most dangerous planet in the universe to ensure the future of his family and his people. As malevolent forces explode into conflict over the planet's exclusive supply of the most precious resource in existence, a commodity capable of unlocking humanity's greatest potential, only those who can conquer their fear will survive. All right, so there's a lot here. And so I want to take just 1 minute and just give some context for the novel, like where the inspiration kind of comes from. Mm-hmm. And then we will dive into the film and we're just going to kind of go from beginning to end and just talk about it. So Frank Herbert wrote this in the 60s. It came out in 1965. And so there's a lot going on in the 60s. Like
2001.
Well, yeah, it is interesting.
You mean in culture or?
Well, it is interesting though. 2001 comes out a couple years after Dune is released, and some will say that Dune actually kind of gave Kubrick like inspiration to make something that big. But yeah, historically, what are some things going on in the 60s?
What is going on in the 60s?
Civil rights?
Yeah, we got civil rights. We got
question mark
women's rights.
Pretty much that.
We've got the counterculture movement that's starting to begin, especially with the introduction of like psychedelics, right? And that's definitely a part of
the drugs.
Dune's. Yeah, yeah.
Nam was during that time then, right?
Yeah. So you had Nam. Yeah, back in Nam, exactly. And you've got the increasing popularity of science fiction fantasy. But it wasn't until Dune where science fiction really, really was taken at a level of seriousness. Because remember, science fiction is not an old genre.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, arguably the first science fiction work is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And that's like just the 19th century. So it's not that old of a genre compared to some of the others. But Dune is really what elevates science fiction. It becomes really popular with the counterculture movement at the time. It's interesting because in that counterculture movement, there's the younger generation that's looking for some sort of leader to guide them, right? You know, they're looking to musicians. They're looking to a lot of spiritual leaders, gurus, yogis, right? They're looking for these people of who am I going to follow? Because a lot of the...
looking at Paul? During that time?
Well, that's interesting, right? Because a lot of the organized religions were starting to fade. They were starting to decline in popularity. And some of the more like esoteric Eastern religions were becoming more popular. Now, when Dune was released, a lot of people thought Paul Atreides was a hero. Mm. And this is why Herbert wrote Dune Messiah, the next book, to just really clarify to people, this is not someone you want to follow.
Yeah.
This is a cautionary tale, right? But this is ultimately written at a time where there's a generation looking for a leader.
Manson family this time?
Manson family is a couple years after this. So yeah. Now Dune has become the best-selling work of science fiction of all time. It's incredibly influential.
It's just a book?
Yeah, the book. The original book. And so there's a lot of really interesting questions that Dune wrestles with. But yeah, so let's go ahead and let's dive into this. So let's start from the opening and we'll just kind of work our way through it. So there's that opening quote where dreams are messages from the deep. What were your first impressions as you kind of started to get into this movie? Because I think, Joe, this was your first time seeing it, right?
Yeah, First off, it's kind of foggy. I meant to watch it last night, but then got caught up with stuff. But from what I remember, it was kind of slow at first.
Yeah, it is a slow burn, for sure.
It was slow, but then caught up. I guess I would say I kind of like the second one more, I guess, only because of the lore that it builds up.
It's just a huge movie.
Yeah.
Scale-wise, it's just enormous.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a lot that it throws at you in the first, like, 30 minutes. You're like, who are the Harkonnens? What is Arrakis? Who's the Atreides, right? Yeah. Like, there's so much lore and mythos that it's throwing really quickly.
It might be an individual thing for me, but I like that stuff when it throws me a lot to think about and wonder for and hope for or hope to see coming.
Yeah.
I was like, ooh, the voice. What? You just force someone to do stuff? That's weird. How's that going to come about?
Yeah, it kind of just throws you into the universe, really. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like that kind of, you're the fish out of water watching everything because everyone in the movie is already experienced in what the movie's about. And it's kind of like, oh, you're learning as things go along. And then with the characters that are learning things as well in the movie, you're learning it with them too.
Yeah.
And there's the weird technology that's different. It's futuristic, but some of this, they're using knives to fight.
Yeah.
They've got shields and you're trying to figure out how they work or how you get past
them.
So
one of the things I read, again, I have not read the book, but one of the things I guess the book mentions is that Dune, like it takes place in the year, I think 191 or something like that.
Yeah.
But a long way off. But apparently
there was like a war.
Human civilization decided to banish like computer technology, robotic technology. So it's almost like we've got this level of technological like advancement, but we're trying to go back to a more primitive way of life, which is, I think, one of the things about Dune is that it's almost like very medieval in a lot of ways, you know? And there's Stukes a lot of things. Yeah, there's a lot of things that pull it. Yes, exactly. So it is interesting because it does make you wonder, like, how did humanity get to that point where they decided that this was better?
Yeah.
Like, this was the way. And obviously, Earth isn't even a thing. Like, whatever happened on Earth, it's irrelevant because we're so far past that. We're on these other planets, right? Yeah.
It's 8,000 years from now.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I did like all the stuff that it threw at you because it made you wonder and it drew you along in the story to find those answers.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Which future is longer, the Wall-E one or this one?
I think this is even further, right?
This has to be the furthest future I think I've ever.
Yeah, I think so too.
Later in 2049 is like,
oh yeah, true.
Down the road, this is 10,000.
That's wild. Yeah.
Wall-E, yeah. They were in there for 700 years.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
They haven't found spice yet, so they couldn't get to other planets.
They were waiting for the spice.
It's all connected.
I think Jason's right with the wonder because the costumes and the characters are so different. Cool. So, like, I think in the beginning of the first one, the space nuns have, mm-hmm. like, these fish tanks over them.
Yeah,
you can't even see their faces. Caladan's actually above the water. Or the mm-hmm. clouds,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So it's just so visually, like, immersive that you're yeah. just trying to get your bearings in the beginning of
you
the
are.
First one, at least, which is a good thing. It's mm-hmm. like you're experiencing something brand new.
By the first hour of this, you're going to know, like, if you're into this or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I really think that you could look at this and be like, this is really silly and over the top. Or you're like, this is epic and amazing.
I think because it takes itself seriously, you can yes. get grounded in the universe more. It's not like in the background you can see like the CGI void and stuff like that. Well, it all looks tangible and real.
That's what kind of separates it from the David Lynch film. Is the David Lynch film is really serious, but also really goofy. Like, mm-hmm. the Harkonnens are in a different mm-hmm. movie altogether. It's so ridiculous.
The acting is what makes it serious. So, like,
yes, really, the performances.
There's really good. I think Oscar Isaac is the mm-hmm. most important person in the first movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He, like, the difference between that one and the first Dune is the acting is so over the top. It feels really weird in the first one, but this one is very. Like, the acting is high quality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody's bringing their A game. Yeah, a lot of great performances. You know, I think that's what really, when you make these kind of films, like, I think that's really what sells it, right?
Yeah.
You got to have a director with a clear vision, and you got to have actors that are taking the material seriously. Mm-hmm. Back in, like, Lord of the Rings, like, the fact that Ian McKellen was Gandalf was a big selling point for a lot of people in, like, oh, this is actually a real movie. Yes.
Huh.
So, cool. I think it's a great set of performances here. Now, when we get into the movie, so we see
side note.
Yeah, go ahead.
I listened to something last night where it just reminded me of this.
Yeah.
Where it says, the who plays Paul?
That's Timothée Chalamet.
Yeah, that this is what Tom Holland wishes he could be, like the type of acting or gigs that he wishes he could get.
I think that's a fair argument.
I was like, damn, that's kind of wild.
Yeah.
Tom Holland in this role. I never thought of that.
I don't want to think of it.
Yeah, exactly. MC.
You know what's funny is for years before I saw Dune, everybody was like, you look just like Timothée Chalamet. And I'm like, who is this? And then I Googled him one day. I was like, oh, yeah. I'm cosplaying for Dune next time at MegaCon. It's happening. But yeah, but speaking of him, right? So Shani's opening, Zendaya's character, her opening narration, her last line there is, who will our next oppressors be?
Oh,
so she comes from the Fremen. So they're the desert people.
Yeah.
And they're more like primitive, right? They're at one with the little nature that there is mm-hmm. in Arrakis. Mm-hmm. But the moment she says that line, who our next oppressors be? And then the title card pops up. And then the next shot you see is Paul waking up.
Really? Okay.
Paul's asleep and he's waking up. That one shot is all of Dune.
Mm.
It's remarkable after seeing parts one and two, how that one shot captures the entire movie.
Yeah.
This is a story about someone waking up. And we'll get into this in the next episode about identity, but is he waking up to who he's meant to be, who he truly is, or is he becoming something that he's waking up to?
Or is he the next oppressor?
Well, yeah, right? That's the question is, will he be? Will he become that? So again, that first 30 minutes, a lot of world building. You see that Paul is the son of Leto, right? Or it's Leto. That's how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Or Leto.
Leto.
But that's Oscar Isaac's character. Yeah. And he's like the traditional, like, political, like, leader, but he has a compassion to him. Mm-hmm. Later in the movie,
yeah,
he has a wisdom. He doesn't want to colonize Arrakis. He wants to learn to live at one with the people.
Yeah.
We're back later in the movie, there's a situation where the they're harvesting the spice and the people, like, they're it's going to blow up. And he's like, damn the spice. We have to get them out, right? Yeah. So he's definitely a different kind of leader than, say, like, the Baron for the Harkonnens, where he's all about control and power and just really colonization kingdom, right? But Paul is also the son of his mother, Lady Jessica. Now, she's a part of a tradition called the Bene Gesserits. Mm-hmm. And so there's almost like this Catholic monastery, but also like this Eastern mysticism, like, kind of put together with them. It's like this deep spiritual religion.
Like, they manipulate, like, everything.
Yeah, they're really the ones behind the scenes, right? Because even the emperor, so the emperor is like that political, like, at the head.
Yeah.
But then there's the great mother, right? Yep. I mean, the women in this story really are in the background kind of shaping everything.
Mm-hmm.
But that's important to keep in mind, is that Paul is the son of both of those characters, and both of those characters are in him. And the question is, which direction is he going to get pulled in, right? Mm. Because he has that conversation early on with his father, and his father's like, are you ready for this? Are you ready to take your place? And he's like, no. Well, you'll find your path. You got to find your path some way. And that's what Leto explains how he did, right?
Yeah, which, by the way, may be the single best scene in both movies.
Yeah, how so?
I just think that's such a powerful scene where his father's like, I just wanted to be a pilot. Like, mm-hmm. taking on something that is a call from, you know, outside yourself, in a sense. And he says to Paul, if you don't choose this, you're still everything you need to be, which is just my son.
Right.
And that's the most powerful moment in the whole series.
Yeah. And that's interesting, because when we get to part two, right, that will come into play, is he is his father's son. But it's interesting because the dad wants a power. He talks about desert power, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about the Fremen that he admires. And it's their ability, I think, at least my interpretation, because I do think there's some ecological stuff going on in this movie, but I do think he admires the way they can live at one with this planet.
Mm-hmm.
That is so harsh of an environment. It never rains. There's no ocean, right? But yet somehow they live in this way that's harmonious with it.
Yeah, they thrive in this environment.
Yeah. And if you think about, like, the Native Americans, right, it's the difference between those who wanted to colonize, who wanted to lord over them, push them out of their land, like the Harkonnens, versus those who wanted to learn from them and live at one with them. So dreams are a very important part of Dune. And even early on, it talks about how there's that line. I think it's Jason Momoa's character, right? Duncan,
mm-hmm.
where is he the one who has the line, dreams make great stories, but everything happens while we're awake, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he says that.
So it's interesting because there are these dreams that he has throughout the film. And this is what causes the great mother to come and test him.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's something they sense with Paul that's off. They're not sure what to do with him, right? They test him with the hand in the box, and we see that Paul's able to resist that test. Then later on, the great mother tells the Baron, don't touch Lady Jessica and Paul. And then that's where he's all slimy and he's like, yeah, I won't do it, but Arrakis. Yeah. Then that's where he has that great line where he floats and he's like, my
Arrakis.
I do. So
the Baron is awesome in the first one.
Oh, my. He is.
The Baron is like very much Apocalypse Now, Marlon Brando type of force.
Yeah, he is a force. That's a good word for it.
I said that I would not harm them, and I shall. My Arrakis is Arrakis.
Don Corleone.
For real.
Space Don.
Space Don.
Now let's talk about
that
when
needs
they
to be on a shirt.
Now let's talk about when they get onto Arrakis, right? So what are some things that start to happen? Like, let's get into that. Well, how do the Fremen react to their coming?
They see Paul. And they seem to recognize Paul.
Yeah. There's a prophecy that the Bene Gesserit, there's a series of prophecies that they planted there over time, right?
Yeah.
Like they're missionaries, basically. And they're trying to sow the seeds of this future hope. And I do think that's interesting, the way that hope can be used to kind of keep a people under control. Because the Fremen have not flat out rebelled.
Yeah.
There is this weird kind of hostility with them, but also there's this longing that they have for something.
Mm.
And Paul, they think he might be the guy, right? They think Paul Atreides might be that Messiah. They've heard rumblings about him, but there's that line where it says they see what they've been told to see.
So I know, did you know Bene Gesserit is from Jesuit?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that makes sense.
Is it Catholicism or whatever? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that he took it from that name.
Well, he grew up, I'm pretty sure Frank Herbert grew up Catholic, right? Yeah, so.
Well, also the head reverend mother is, that conversation with between her and Lady Jessica is really cool because in that moment, they both know exactly what is going to happen. And Lady Jessica knows everybody's going to die but her and Paul because she says his sight is barely awakened and now he goes into the fire.
Yeah.
A path has been laid. Don't squander it.
Mm.
And then we go, and when Paul gets there, we see that the evidence of that path, the people saying Lisan al Ghaib and
right, all that stuff. Right. Mm. Yeah. So it's like there's something laid out there, and Lady Jessica senses that. She knows. And that's, you don't really get to see until part two what's really her role is in all this.
Yeah.
But for now, she knows she has to keep her son alive. And so then we get to where we learn that the emperor is going to send the Harkonnens to come and to wipe out Atreides because those who are in power, the great mother, the emperor, they've grown distrustful of them.
Yeah, because the other systems are starting to like the house of like Atreides, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they like the house because, again, like he's kind. He is merciful. He is more compassionate towards like individuals. So the emperor and the great mothers don't want that. So.
Yeah, they see him as a threat.
Well, it's mostly because they're defiant and they can't be controlled. So if they could and they got that backing, it's a little different. But
and they're like the greatest army in this universe as well.
Well, and it's interesting because the Great Mother telling the Baron to spare them, does that imply that the Great Mother believes that Paul can be controlled at that point?
Probably she believes that he could. But it grows beyond, spoilers for the next
one. Yeah.
It grows beyond her control. But I feel like that's a running theme of both of these movies, like the hubris of people to try to control.
Control.
Yeah.
Well, controlling your destiny, controlling how things play out, right? Because we here in 2024, you know, we get encouraged like to take life into our own hands, control your destiny, like don't let anybody else write your story. Mm-hmm. Like all these things. And so it's interesting because everybody is operating with that mindset.
Yeah.
And Paul doesn't know where he's probably the one in part one who most is oblivious to everything going on. He feels like he has no control of his destiny. I mean, the Harkonnens come and then they take out the kingdom, basically. They kill his father. Well, you know, kind of. They have that awesome scene where he bites down, right? He's told the doctor betrays him. He
blows things in his face,
Yeah, that's a great, I love that.
I thought.
Some of the best scenes are in the first one.
Yeah, I agree.
I thought that he died the first time, but then he was resurrected. I called him Penguin in my notes. Baron? Yeah, the Baron.
Yeah. Oh, the Baron?
Yeah. The Baron.
Yeah.
But that scene with him lying like this on his back.
He just bites down.
The table.
Here I lie, here I remain.
Yeah, it's so good. But,
the scene with the Duke or Paul and Leto is not in the book.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, really. That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that.
He created that scene. I thought those are the best lines, I think, in the whole thing. And
I do agree. I think a lot, especially in part two as well, I think in both movies, some of my favorite lines of dialogue did not come from the book.
Yeah.
Then you have Leto, he dies. And the Harkonnens have taken over.
Yeah, he does.
And this is where Paul begins to use what's called the voice, right? Mm-hmm. And you see that there's this slow movement into control that Paul is experiencing. So everything is about learning to control who you are, your destiny, where you go, right? So like, for example, earlier in the movie, Paul is dueling, right? Mm-hmm. He's practicing with Gurney. And there's a lot of conversations about like, don't turn your back. His mother will say that later. There's about the slow blade is what penetrates, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just quickly like go in. You have to kind of, and that'll come into play in part two. But then when there's the scene of him and the mother and they're on the helicopter, which by the way, these helicopters.
The ornithopter?
Yeah. The bugs, amazing. Amazing design. Miyazaki actually used them in his first film.
Wait, Nick, which one would you want? These ones or the Kylo Kylo Ren.
Well, I think it's Nick Fury's truck.
Really?
Because that thing can fly too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would expect that.
Yeah. It's either that one. No, Kylo Ren.
Kylo Ren.
I'll just float around in that one.
Yeah. So in that scene, Lady Jessica says that you got to have the right pitch. So you have to learn to control your voice a certain way in order to control other people.
Yeah.
Right? So you have to have a control of yourself, a self-control, and then you can manipulate others. And then when we get to where they meet up with the Fremen and they're going to start learning their ways, there's a sense of control. Like, he has to learn to control the way he walks, right? He has to learn the desert walk. He has to learn to control the way he consumes water, right?
I don't even feel like it's control. I feel like that's more adapting. Control is what he does with the voice. When he's doing that in the desert, that's more adapting to the way of the desert.
Yeah. I guess controlling like your body, right? Controlling like parts of you. Because some of it is physical. Some of it is mental.
Yeah.
Right? And even like being able to, I think the ultimate peak of this is the sandworm, is being able to not let the sandworm control your fate, your destiny. Because these sandworms are these big monsters that just, they're chaos. They engulf everything. But if you can learn to ride the worm, right? If you can ride chaos, then you can fully control where you go. Because that is the peak of chaos on Arrakis. And if you can control that, which control just means holding on, you're along for the ride.
It's desert power.
Right? But that's desert power. Exactly. And so I think that desert power is that ability to fully adapt, to be in control of yourself, right? And then thereby, that's what leads to controlling your destiny. And I think the Harkonnens are the opposite. I think the Harkonnens are, they all act out of, at least the two nephews, right? They act out of emotion. Mm-hmm. You know, Dave Bautista's character, the older nephew, he's very raw rage, anger all the time, right? And then when we talk about the younger one and the next one, Austin Butler's character, he's all lust and passion.
Pleasure.
But it's all this like emotion that everything, and I think that's what will lead to their downfall. Whereas I think the House of Atreides and the Fremen, I think why they gel so well together is because I think their philosophies in some ways are compatible. I think one of my favorite scenes that I think we have to talk about is the scene where Paul, so we learn that Paul, when he's around the spice, he has these visions. And I think this is like the psychedelic culture that Herbert has a commentary on there. But he has these visions, these dreams of what could be. And there's the one where he's just with his mother and he says there's spice in the tent, right? He starts having these visions. His mom is trying to like walk him through it as he's experiencing. It's like a bad acid trip. And the mom is asking like what he fears. Mm-hmm. And he keeps saying like, I see a holy war. Like everyone's fighting in my name, worshiping at my father's skull. And he talks about this like warrior religion. And it's, that scene is so good because you start to see that Paul is, he's becoming a part of something bigger than him. And it's taking control of him, right? He has no control in that moment. He's just witnessing this unfold. And the mom keeps trying to tell him, you know who you are. You know who you are.
But the mom is wanting him to be that person.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the tension of the scene. Yeah. She says, you are Paul Atreides. You are your father's son. You are my son. And I'm like, that's the tension right there that he's in. Because then, do you guys remember how Paul lashes back at her? When he yells,
you Bene Gesserit made me a freak.
Yes, yes.
Like you did this.
You did this to me. Yeah. So it's interesting because I think Paul's waking up to, because there's a whole manipulation about like the birth and how Lady Jessica was supposed to have a daughter, but then instead, I guess they can have control over the sex of it.
Yeah. His baby.
And so Paul's starting to wake up to this, but it's interesting because the mom, like you said, Nick, is trying to sit there and say, you know who you are, but at the same time, she's going to almost manipulate who he is. And the mother is saying, this is who you really are. You really are going to be this messianic figure. You really are going to be this person. And Paul's like, I'm not so sure. But then she also says, like, you are your father's son. So it's like this
she's trying to tie the identities together.
Well, yes. Ooh, that's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, but the full-on manipulation of that doesn't really come until
Part two
for yes. sure.
And there's a specific thing that happens that causes that. So.
When you even see part of part two in that vision where there's the fight, where they're like, he's with the Fremen.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, that's actually, that scene is in part two. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which I didn't catch until I rewatched it.
Yeah. But in this movie, she says we have to get off world back to Caladan. Like, she doesn't want to stay there. She wants to take him off. So it's like,
right.
She's actually trying to get him away from that path.
But why? That's the interesting thing. Is like, is she unsure at that point if that's the direction
she
should
is.
Go in?
I think she's just in survival mode, and she hasn't committed to that until part two, because she said we have to get off world to Caladan. Like, we can't stay here with the Fremen. We have to go.
Which one is, what planet is that again? Or is that a planet, or is that a group?
Caladan's where they came from. That's their home.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where all the water is. And he says, no, my path leads into the desert.
Yeah.
My path's with the Fremen. So he's the one who initiates that, which not necessarily the prophesied path. That's not what he's going for, but he mm-hmm. says, this is where I have to go. And his mom is just like, we have to get out of here. We have to survive.
Right. Mm-hmm. Then we get to where they meet the Fremen. And I agree. I think they're in like this survival self-preservation mode. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because I think Paul is seeing, oh, this is how we survive. We need to be at one with the Fremen. If we're with them, right? Because literally at this point, to as far as their knowledge goes, they're the last two of the House of Atreides. And so being able to form this alliance with the Fremen is key, because Paul's old life is slowly being stripped away from him. His dad, Duncan, you know, Gertie.
Yeah.
The Leto side.
His Leto side is getting pulled away bit by bit. And so with the Fremen,
it's like he no longer becomes a son.
Yes.
He rejects it.
Yeah, but and it's interesting because he says, like, this is my path. Like, this is the way for me.
I think in a way, maybe he is honoring his father, because he says, my father sought this planet not for its resources, but for the power of its people.
Yeah.
And so in a way, he's continuing with what his father had set in front of him, and he's going with that.
Yeah,
I agree.
But he's still going to use them for his own gain.
You don't know that right now.
Oh, that's fair.
Well, I think that's the part one.
We're still in part one.
Yeah, that's
but I think that's still the, in part but one. I think you're right. I think that's the paradox. Yeah. I think that's why this is so complex, because I think he is moving further away from being his father's son, but at the same time, this is also a different way of expressing that in his own path, for better or for worse. So when we get to the end of the movie, there's a couple interesting quotes that you start to get at the end. So you get the fear is the mind killer, right? Which is something that mm-hmm. the mother says throughout the movie. But part of what Paul is doing is he has to overcome these fears, right? And so one of the ways that the Fremen test him is you have that guy, please remember.
Jamis.
Yeah, Jamis, right? Jamis. And he almost like doesn't think that Paul is worthy of being there. And so it's a great, like, this is like a storytelling. It's like a classic hero's journey stuff, right? This is his crossing the threshold. Like, this is how Paul starts to become a Fremen. Because he can hang out with them, but he's not one of them yet until he does this. Because this is their code, right? And if he kills this guy, he essentially takes his place. And so they have that final knife duel, and Paul has, even though he has all this training, he's never actually been in the field like this, right?
Yeah, he never killed somebody.
Yeah. So this is, and there's that line where it says, when you take a life, you take your own. Mm. And so that line, I think, is so key, because I do think the moment he takes his life, I think it seals Paul's destiny in a way. I think, ironically, as Paul is going to try in the next film to control his destiny even further, I think destiny has taken a control of him once he's taken this life. Mm. Because when you could take one life, you're going to have no problem taking, because then he's going to be, I'll take the lives of the Harkonnens for revenge. Then, you know, I will sit back, and even if the lives of my own people are taken, I will still press forward with this, right?
That's why Batman has the rule.
Yeah.
Right. Well, this is why a lot of stories have the rule. But when you take a life, you take your own. That's so profound, because I think this is the moment that sets Paul. It's the crossing of the threshold. He's moving from the known of being the House of Atreides to the unknown. And the movie ends with that ambiguity of what's going to happen next for Paul, right? Because I think this is where his hero's journey, like, this is where it really takes off. And I say hero's journey in quotes because I don't quite know how to make of it as a hero's journey. Any thoughts on kind of like the ending, like the last kind of final moments?
Yeah, so I thought the dream the vision he had about Jamis was super, it added a lot of depth to it, and it threw me through a loop.
Which movie?
Part one.
He had a dream of Jamis?
Yeah. He said, the voices were telling him to find the friend.
Right.
So the vision of Jamis, I felt, really added a lot of depth, and it threw me through a loop because I thought that they were going to be friends because the voices were saying, find the friend, he will show you the way, and Jamis is looking all kind and talking to him. He's like, yeah, this is how this goes. And
well, it's weird because he does show him the way in the next film, right? Through the vision.
Right, but, Jamis is the key through which he gains entrance into the Fremen, and he also learns their way of life, right. How harsh it is,
right.
How serious, but there's still like an honor in it, and there's a hierarchy, but he's going to have to take a life and learn the severity of the desert, and he learns it through Jamis and through his fight with him. But it was so weird because you see the visions of them being friends, and he's Paul's friend, but this dude wants to kill him.
Yeah.
And he's yelling at him, and I'm just like, dude, what's your deal? Like, just let him be, but no. This is what happens.
Yeah. Who's this outsider to come to our group? Yeah. Just letting him in.
No, I'm not letting him.
Yeah. There's visions with Shawnee, too, because he sees the vision of his death, and Shawnee is the one, right? Mm-hmm.
And then he sees Shawnee kill him, too.
Yeah, so that's interesting as well, because that first time he sees her, it's kind of like, whoa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen you before, right? And obviously she has no idea, but she'll become very important in the next one. But
even when she gave the knife to Paul and was saying, you know, he's a skilled fighter. You know, here is this. You deserve an honorable death as well.
Yeah.
Like that's.
I think it's honor that makes the Atreides and the Fremen ideologies mesh well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I'll end on here, there's a great book I always recommend to my clients called The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. It's by Jonathan Gottschall. It's, I think, one of the best books out there in terms of understanding our relationship with story. And so there's a quote here that I want to read that I think will tie some things in with this film, but also set us up for where the next film goes. Talks about the storytelling mind is allergic to uncertainty, randomness, and coincidence. It is addicted to meaning. If the storytelling mind cannot find meaningful patterns in the world, it will try to impose them. In short, the storytelling mind is a factory that churns out true stories where it can, but will manufacture lies where it can't.
I think of the mothers and I think of all the behind-the-scenes stuff. Like, they are literally manufacturing things that they shouldn't.
Right.
But, and all in the name of what their idea is, a peaceful world or a good world for humanity.
Well, and it's interesting because this idea of the power of dreams and controlling your destiny, the fact that our brains, our minds want a sense of certainty, we want a sense of direction, we want a sense of meaning. To the point where if we can't find those things, we will try to make them. We will try to make them happen. And I think that's what happens here is Paul Atreides loses pretty much everything besides his mom. And the only thing that's left of him symbolically, right, of what his mom represents is this Bene Gesserit path.
Yeah.
Is this path of manipulation, this path of messianic prophecy and destiny. I do think that Paul could have lived at peace, at one with the Fremen, but not as a messianic figure if he would have followed his dad's way.
Yeah.
But the fact that that's all gone now, that's all killed, and Paul, I think, is looking for some sort of sense of direction and purpose, and his mom is the only one there, right?
That's kind of like with Anakin and Qui-Gon, to be honest. I literally just thought of that because Qui-Gon was in the picture, Anakin would have went down a whole different path. But because Qui-Gon died, Anakin went down this darker path.
Well, in the first movie, it's the Phantom Menace, Qui-Gon dies. And then in the second movie, his mother dies.
Yeah.
And then the third movie, there's a threat of Padme dying. So I think those are the three events that seal Anakin's fate, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Dune Part 1, I think, is all about sealing Paul's fate. Because I think once Part 2 gets going, it's just going to unfold. But I think this movie really carefully, and I love the slow pacing of how it does it, but it slowly and subtly reveals how somebody's destiny can unfold, right? And again, who is controlling that destiny? Is it Paul? Is it some sort of higher powers? Because the Bene Gesserit, they think it might be, but they're also not in control of this story. Is it the mother? Is it Lady Jessica? Like, who is really in control? Who is it? And yeah, I think that's what it's, again, it's all Paul Atreides waking up to something. And it's the power of these dreams, these visions. And I think when we think of our lives, we have these dreams and visions for our own life that can take hold of us, right? And when they take hold of us, great things can happen. Again, in the 60s, lots of people, like, I have a dream. Like, Martin Luther King had a powerful dream. Lots of people in the 60s had these radical dreams and visions for how the world could look. But there were also destructive dreams. There were also dreams of messianic worship, which was very, very high at this time period. And I think even today, we live in a time where people are looking for a leader. I think politically, this is incredibly relevant now, right? Whether you put your eggs in one basket for Biden or Trump or whatever leader, this is, people are searching and they're desperate and they will. Again, according to this quote, if they cannot find meaning, they will try to impose it, even if it's churning out lies.
That is the, that right there is what the Bene Gesserit embodies 100%.
Yeah.
Because they are looking for a leader. They don't have one, but they are trying to create a leader who can see all the paths of the future and guide them down the right one. So they want, they're trying to get the certainty, the 100% right. certainty.
Right.
And they want to know exactly which way is humanity supposed to go.
Yeah.
And they're creating these lies and they're spinning all these things so that they can have 100% certainty of what the best way to go is and be led yeah. down that path.
Yeah.
But they'll do the very, very destructive things to create that. And they are desperate. That's why they plan so much. That's why they've been planning for centuries and centuries. It's yeah. like a lot of manipulation and fear.
Yeah.
But what they're failing is, or what they're failing to know is that something isn't beautiful because it lasts.
Oh my gosh. Speaking of things not lasting, this episode is coming to an end. So dreams are not meant to be kept to ourselves. We need to help nurture and harness those dreams in healthy ways. If you are ready to do this, then consider booking a free 30-minute discovery call. In this conversation, we'll discuss the dreams you have of where you want your story to go, and we'll talk about how storytelling can help us evaluate those dreams and whether they're attainable and whether they are something that we should give ourselves to. So all you have to do for that discovery call, again, it's free. Visit the link in our show notes. You can book that discovery call with me. And I'd love to connect. And in the meantime, join us next week for Dune Part 2. Thank you for listening to the Live a Meaningful Story podcast, produced by All Things Narrative. If you'd like to learn more about our coaching, workshops, events, please check out allthingsnarrative.com. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at All Things Narrative. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and tune in next time as we continue exploring the stories we love and the stories we live. Take care.